Some of you are going to find this a bit incredulous, but here's something that federal, state, and local governments all tell us to do that we should actually listen to. Eat more fruits and vegetables. You've heard about the health benefits of increasing plant-based nutrients into your diet, but how can you easily consume all the fruits and veggies needed? Well, it's easy. By adding grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity into your meals. Grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity is a power blend that has 31 fruits and vegetables in every scoop. Organic vegetables, super greens, super fruits, and super sprouts. It is fortified with essential vitamins plus an immunity boost. And right now, you can get a free 2-week supply of grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity by just paying $8.95 for the shipping and handling. And not only that, you'll also get a free frother to quickly whip up your healthy and nutritious grown American drink. Go to grownamericansuperfood.com/John and order today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
Welcome back to SiriusXM. I'm John Fugelsang. Oh, I'm so excited we got Amanda Marcotte back on the show. She is senior politics writer at Salon, one of the sharpest players in the game when it comes to our current national state. She is the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters, Set on Rat-Fucking Liberals America, and Truth Itself. You need to follow her on Twitter at Amanda Marcotte and on Mastodon as well, and sign up for her biweekly politics newsletter, Standing Room Only. Ms. Marcotte, welcome back to SiriusXM.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, I'm just so glad to have you here to celebrate Donald Trump selling Bibles. It's really exciting. Only $60. And did you know this, Amanda? The only Bible endorsed by Trump. All those other Bibles are a hoax. You have a great piece in Salon on this about how Trump Bibles make a mockery of Christianity. And that's exactly why MAGA will eat them up. What were your first thoughts when you heard he was following up the gold puffy sneaker merch with the Bible, with the Lee Greenwood lyrics merch?
So much of the article comes back to the paragraph kind of in the middle of it about how I realized that there's no way that that is as advertised a King James Bible, because he's holding it even with his tiny little hands that make everything look bigger. Like, it's really obvious that the thing weighs about as much as like the Catcher in the Rye, right?
Yes, yes.
And it has big print, and like, I was like, oh, that's maybe a few excerpts or possibly just blank inside.
Right. He said it's easy to read, large print, and slim design. And I'm like, that's a heck of a book. How large is the print?
Yeah. My last time I owned a copy of the Bible, it was one of those with the like really thin paper and the teeny tiny print. And it was still like a doorstop.
He said the Bible contains, yeah, you got it. The King James Version also includes the Founding Father documents. I don't know what that is. Madison's driver's license. I don't know. And a copy of the lyrics of God Bless America from Lee Greenwood. That's the one Lee Greenwood song they choose to use. And Trump said, you have to have it for your heart, for your soul. But you made a great point at the end of your piece when you stated, even before Trump's version of a Bible was being sold, his hollowed out version of faith had cannibalized what was left of evangelical Christianity, which had already spent decades remaking itself as the culture war arm of the GOP. My God, what you do with the language. What is the serious takeaway from this ridiculous bit of news? What does this tell us about his current supporters and his current cult?
I mean, like I said in that, I don't want to like make it sound like he's the breaking point necessarily, where the evangelical, like this has been going on for decades with evangelicals. They became political, they became more and more tied to right-wing politics. But what I think is interesting about Trump and what he's done is that he has kind of created this situation, and you see it in all sorts of levels of where people call themselves evangelicals, where that word has lost even the pretense of Christian compassion, right?
So true. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about George W. Bush, and he at least was from an era where like evangelical Christians would sort of try to talk about Christ's love and compassion and try to at least, you know, pretend that they cared about that stuff. And like he did PEPFAR. So there was like sometimes putting a little money where the mouth was. But like Trump not only doesn't believe in any of this crap, but he doesn't even really pretend to. I mean, he does in this very shallow way that literally everyone sees through, including his evangelical supporters. Like if you ask them, they'll say, oh, no, of course he doesn't believe in God. And I think what he's created is this permission structure to say, oh, I never needed to like care about Jesus in order to be a Christian. I never needed to like be compassionate or pretend even to be compassionate.
You're right.
It's just the identity without any ideology, any theology, nothing.
That's it. It's camouflage and nothing else. I mean, MAGA does not fight for any of the teachings of this Nazarene. Trump has violated all 10 of the Ten Commandments. They just don't care. And you write, liberals assume MAGA doesn't get this. I disagree. I think MAGA loves Trump's contempt for the Bible. He gives them permission to redefine Christianity as a religion of hate instead of Jesus's love. And you nail it. I mean, what they've been pushing at us for the last 7 or 8 odd years is the flawed vessel talking point, that God chooses imperfect vessels to bring about his will. And that's when I usually bring up to them, so which teachings of Jesus has the imperfect vessel brought forward? And it's still none. They live in this bubble where they can lie to each other. But I'll be honest, I always just assumed it was about MAGA ignorance of what's actually in the Bible. I think you're right. I mean, they have their Messiah. He's living and breathing and selling them hats, and he gives them permission to remake Christianity into this hate cult.
Yeah, I did a big reporting piece recently for Salon about sort of online Christian propaganda. And one of the things that I learned from it doing this research is that not only are 40% of self-identified evangelicals basically unchurched, they don't go to church at all.
Yeah.
At all. The ones that still do, like, there's a lot of reason to believe that the churches have just given up kind of any kind of traditional Christian teaching, and it's just MAGA all the time. Like, it's like no more Sermon on the Mount, no more even pretending to care about that, just COVID denialism and right-wing talking points, you know?
Yeah. That's it. I mean, and speaking of fake Christians, the Supreme Court arguments on banning abortion pills has been at the top of every news story this week. Of course, once again, abortion, something that the Bible never prohibits, Judaism never prohibits, Jesus never speaks against, but it has replaced Christianity for right-wing Christians. And you were so on it in Salon regarding the Mifepristone argument. Your latest piece highlights a different aspect of the story. How does Erin Hawley, Amanda, she's the wife of adolescent insurrectionist fan club president Josh Hawley, how does Erin Hawley play into all of this? Because she had a very interesting week, I think, and I don't think it went the way she expected it to.
No, she's been a anti-choice crusader for a long, long time, right? She was part of the legal team that helped get the Dobbs decision done. She argued against the abortion pill in front of the Supreme Court. I listen to those arguments because I'm a sick mofo. I thought what was interesting about what she said, like she does a lot of public appearances where she trots out the kind of like standard anti-choice line where we're just trying to protect women and casting abortion doctors as kind of predatory and stuff. But even in arguments, I think it fell apart really quickly. And all she would talk about is these supposedly poor, beleaguered anti-choice doctors who live in terror of the day where they might have to deal with a patient who has had an abortion that was incomplete mm-hmm. and needs medical care afterwards. That doesn't happen nearly as often as she implied. And then...
No, because again, if I may, mifepristone, safer than pregnancy, safer than childbirth. Yeah. There are no problems. It's been sold legally and approved by the FDA for 24 years. This is just their latest crazy scheme. I'm so sorry. Well, go on.
No, and you get at something really important here, which is like one thing that she didn't admit in the cases is if you take away that particular pill, you can still do medication abortion, but there will be more incomplete abortions. So mm-hmm. with mifepristone plus misoprostol, when you take the two pills together, I think that the completion rate is like something like 95%. If yes. you only do the misoprostol, it's like 80%. So you're going to see a lot more ER visits if this pill is banned. So even the premise of their argument was backwards. And it was, it's a very frustrating situation because that didn't even come up. And I was like, you're going to see a lot more ER visits.
Yeah. I mean, and as you note, every word of Erin Hawley was disingenuous. For those who don't understand how deeply ingrained she is on this issue, what makes her remarks so egregious?
Well, you know, one thing I really flagged during arguments that was kind of in the weeds a little bit, really telling to me, was that at one point they asked her why there have been more women going to the emergency rooms after taking abortion pills. And there has been an uptick. It's a small one, but there has been one. And she said she admitted that the reason is because of the Dobbs decision. A lot more women are getting the abortion pills, say if they live in Indiana, they go to a state nearby, they get the pills, they come home, they take them. They might have more bleeding than they expected. And so they'll call the doctor and they'll say, well, you're probably okay, but you should go to the emergency room just to make sure that everything's okay. And it almost always is. That's most of those cases. But she admitted that's why this is happening. Whereas if you live next to the doctor, they can look at it for you. And I was like, this is, so you're wanting to make this argument based on a rise in emergency room visits you yourself caused. You personally That's caused it. Erin Hawley. Like if she and her team had not tried to get the Dobbs decision, we would just be in the situation where women can get abortions and their doctor is in their community and they can just ask that person for help.
You're right. Let me quote you again from this piece. ADF used a favorite Republican trick to conceal misogynist intent. Have a lady say it. Erin Hawley was tapped to play the role of snarling church lady pretending to protect the naughty sex havers from having a say over their own bodies. Erin Hawley continues the proud GOP tradition of women building their careers by ruining other women's lives. Is that how it benefits her? Is that why she does it? I mean, she stands to personally benefit from all the pain she's causing these other women, doesn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's in her heart necessarily, but I've just seen this pattern over and over again with Republican women, which is like they live in this world where the ladder that they can climb is built on other women's backs, right?
Yeah.
That they can build their career by attacking women's rights, often ones that they don't necessarily need access to because they're either so rich that they can get that care somewhere else, or they're postmenopausal, you know, so they can go after reproductive rights. But it's like, it's so frustrating because she went to Yale. She was a Supreme Court justice clerk. She's had all these benefits in life that the feminist movement made available to her. And mm-hmm. she's using those advantages to pull up the rope. I mean... Because that's why they want to ban abortion. That's why they want to restrict contraception. It's not pro-life. It's because these are tools women, especially women that don't have these financial advantages, I'm sure she had growing up, need in order to go to school, to get a job, et cetera, et cetera.
You're totally right. I mean, if they really wanted to end abortion, if they wanted to end unwanted pregnancy, they'd be talking a lot more about access to birth control and sex ed in schools. They don't, because they don't. It's all about power. And I think you nailed it. Let me quote you one more time on this. The actual reason ADF wants to restrict access to abortion pills, it's the same reason they oppose contraception and same-sex marriage rights. They are theocrats who want to end secular law and impose a far-right Christian nationalist agenda on all Americans. I'm not so sure, however, Amanda, they came all that close this week. It seems like the Republican Party, being the dog that caught the car, has realized they're the dog that caught the car. And after IVF, and they pulled back from that. And now it seems this week, these justices, they're still looking for a path to fetal personhood. I don't think they're going to go for it before the next election day. How do you think this whole thing went in the end?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. Like, I agree that the Republican hacks on the court are a little worried about what will happen if they make some big anti-abortion decision this year. So I wouldn't dispute that that's probably part of what they're thinking. I think that they're not going to decide against the abortion pill because the legal theory was so out there that it would open a can of worms that even like the radicals on the court don't want to open, which is like, literally, if they let these doctors sue and get the bill, the abortion pill banned because of their say so, you or I or anybody could challenge literally any federal regulation.
It's true.
They don't want to be dealing with those particular cases. But I do want to flag that two of the justices, Alito and Thomas, went really hard on trying to argue a point that was in the original brief that Aaron Hawley wrote for this, which argued that the Comstock Law, which is an 1873 law that banned pornography, contraception, and abortion.
Anything basically. Lewd. Yeah, anything lewd.
Yeah, and it hasn't actually ever been repealed. Like they really grabbed that bone and they went with it. They were trying to argue that the Comstock Law is live law and that it should be enforced again. And so I don't think this is over. And I think Alito and Thomas at least definitely have a theory where they're asking the religious right to bring cases based on the Comstock Law. And if they do, that's game over because it's the birth control pill, that's condoms, that's any obscene material.
But not Viagra, Amanda. The Viagra is not lewd, I guess. Something that's only for male pleasure, not lewd material. Not a problem. Put a stamp on it.
They will go after porn. That's definitely the Comstock Law super bans porn.
But I mean, wouldn't a smart Democratic Party point out that this leads to government bureaucrats going through citizens' mail? That's the slippery slope we're on right now. Doesn't it seem that way?
Yeah, I mean, that's originally what the Comstock Law does, is it says that you have a postal service that goes through your mail and looks to see if you are mailing illegal stuff. But because of our modern like shipping and the internet and stuff, it would cover all that as well. So it would be like the way it's written, it would be much more extensive than that.
We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back. This is Progress.
Hi there. It's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I'm John Fugelsang. This is Progress After Dark. Can I ask you really quick about Donald Trump's legal issues? Because that miniseries is not going away. We are now looking forward to the first ever trial for an ex-president. That's the real story this week. I don't care about his bond being reduced. But you wrote last week something about Trump's legal trials that has stuck in my mind. You said Trump's criminal cases are his campaign. And I agree. As fun as it is to watch his daughter-in-law begin to loot the RNC, how will he spin this, and what do you think the results will be now that it seems pretty clear the big money donors are not coming back? I mean, he's selling sneakers and Bibles and cologne right now during Holy Week.
I mean, I think that a lot of them will come home because they really want that tax cut. But it is probably really difficult to donate to Donald Trump's legal defense, which is where the money is going.
That's why they do it through the PAC, right? So because Trump donors don't know they're donating to his legal defense. They think they're donating to get him elected or to stop the steal. They have no idea their money's going for E. Jean Carroll to go shopping.
Well, it's funny because he is trying to triangulate this where he's like, his fundraising emails are like, they're coming for Trump Tower. They want to put me in jail. Like has made the legal troubles the centerpiece of his campaign. And as I argue in that piece, I think this is more than just his ego. I think there's like kind of a theory that they're working with, which is that he's like such a symbol for MAGA grievance and their belief that they've been unjustly pushed out of their high status in American society. Trump Tower becomes like the symbol of like white privilege being attacked or whatever.
Totally agree.
I still don't know how effective that's going to be, especially when he's actually on trial. Like, it's one thing when it's like this kind of abstract thing, when he's sitting there making frowny faces while Stormy Daniels talks about how she basically had to have sex with him to make him go away. Like, I think that's not going to be as sexy as they're coming for Trump Tower.
I mean, in your new Standing Room Only newsletter, you talk about why it's entirely fair to demand Trump pay up after losing his massive fraud trial. I mean, I was amazed at how many folks I saw out there talk about how excessive the fines were without actually complaining about the crimes that incurred the fines in the first place. I mean, it's all about how these fines are cruel and unusual punishment. Heard that Eighth Amendment talk all week. When Donald Trump literally campaigned on bringing back torture in violation of the Eighth Amendment, it just seems like it's food for the cult.
Yeah, Jamelle Bouie made a really good point in his last New York Times column, which is there are people that sit in Rikers for years because they can't come up with a $3,000 bond.
Yeah.
And people are out here moaning and groaning that a so-called billionaire has to pay $500 million for literally, as far as I can tell, 4 decades of fraud.
Yeah.
And people keep saying victimless crime. I'm like, no, because first of all, we're all the victims here.
Yeah. Anyone who pays their taxes and doesn't lie to banks and insurance companies is the victim here.
Yeah. Yeah. How much more money do New Yorkers have to pay? And New York taxes are not great. I've lived in New York. They suck. But like, you know, also, I think we're going to find out what this upcoming criminal trial, because again, it's being talked about as like victimless crime, but we're going to see witnesses sit on the stand and say, no, he victimized me. Michael Cohen was victimized by him. Stormy Daniels was victimized by him. Alan Weiselberg is sitting in prison because of the fraud that Trump was tried for civilly and got this fine for. Like, the notion that this is just some kind of money game is wrong. People have gone to jail. People have been assaulted. It's terrible.
It's really, really true. I want to leave it with the million-dollar question, though. The gag order is back in place now, and you wrote, the one thing we can be absolutely sure of, Trump will violate this until he's thrown in jail. Will this judge have the guts to enforce it? That is the only question. I've asked this question so many times, Amanda, over the past year, and I honestly feel for any judge in that position because it does seem like he's trying to get his bail revoked in all of these cases and get thrown into jail for the kind of talk that would get any normal person thrown in jail for a long period of time. But is it possible that these judges also know that if he was thrown in jail, he'd probably fundraise $1 million off of it the first weekend, and it might help his movement disproportionately? Could that be a reason why he knows he can get away with so much of this?
I don't think so. I think, honestly, it's that he's a sociopath who doesn't believe that he's going to face a consequence because he never has. If I'm being honest, like,
yeah, no, I like your answer better.
Yeah, he's just oppositional defiance disorder. I'm not a psychologist, but like, I know that these are symptoms of these personality disorders. And like, he just very consistently is the guy who pushes the limit to see if anyone will give him pushback. I mean, that's why he's a sexual predator. It's the same behavior, right? Yeah. He just corners a woman and basically is like, are you going to fight back? Are you going to fight back? You know?
Yeah.
It's gross and it's terrible behavior. And unfortunately, the only thing you can do with someone like that is to actually fight back.
But the Christians just love it. Amanda Marcotte is the senior politics writer at Salon. What is the best way for our evil army of the night to follow you and keep up with all your work?
I'm at salon.com and I have a newsletter there called Standing Room Only.
It's so good. Amanda, I'm always thrilled to get you on the show. Thank you so much for classing up the room. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Welcome back to SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang. I am so excited to welcome this next guest to our program. As you know, if you listen to this show, more than 1 in 4 Native Americans live in poverty, and that's the highest rate of any group in the United States. And the poverty rate's even higher for those who are living on reservations. Less than 50% of Native homes right now are connected to a public sewer system, and of those, 16% lack indoor plumbing, 14% of those homes lack electricity. Now, this is in an incredible contrast when you look at the challenges reservations face with the opportunity to access the billions of dollars of natural resources that's already existing on their sovereign lands. And right now, there's a lot of push and funding for renewable projects on Indian land. But, of course, structural and political and regulatory barriers have always made it difficult for First Nations people to take advantage of development opportunities. So the Department of Energy is becoming a point of contact and education, guiding groups towards funding, seminars on wind and solar power. And the DOE just announced their first ever loan guarantee under a decades-old tribal financing program that's never been used to back a project. The Loans Program Office announced a conditional commitment for a $72.8 million partial loan guarantee to finance development of a solar and long-duration energy storage microgrid on the tribal lands of the Viejas Band of Indians in Southern California. Wahela Johns is director of the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Indian Energy Programs and Policy. She's responsible for upholding and advancing the office's mission to maximize the development and deployment of energy solutions for the benefit of American Indians and Alaskan Natives. She's a member of the Navajo Nation, comes from Northeast Arizona. Her work on the Black Mesa Water Coalition and Navajo Green Economy Coalition has already led to groundbreaking victories for groundwater protection, green jobs, and environmental justice. It is a great pleasure to welcome Director Wahela Johns to SiriusXM.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor. I was very curious. I think most of our listeners would probably be shocked to learn that as of last year, approximately 20,000 Native homes still don't have electricity in this century. And specifically, studies say 21% of Navajo Nation homes and 35% of Hopi tribe homes are still unelectrified. How does an office like yours begin to work on solving structural inequalities like that?
Well, I was born and raised in my community. Most people don't have access to electricity, and so I think when you have not that access, it also feels this part in you that you want to make sure that there's access, right, to electricity, yes, to running water, all of the infrastructure that, you know, most Americans enjoy. And sadly, as you mentioned, many Native American families still struggle to have access to power and water, but also connectivity. I think, you know, access to electricity is a human right. It's estimated over a billion people globally don't have access to power. And I think that being here in the United States, you have to look historically at why is it in this way where we have populations within the U.S. that don't have access to power. And it goes back to like the 1923 Electrification Act. Much of it was designed that actually excluded tribal reservations or tribes. And so when they did the build out of electrification, you know, that's where I think you do have areas that were not included. And, mm-hmm. You know, the good thing is that tribes are, you know, establishing their tribal utility, you know, making sure that they have their own utility services, but also they understand more of like what's happening on the ground. There are a number of initiatives happening to electrify these homes in rural, remote places. Many times families can't afford. I mean, one mile of an extension of a power line could cost over $40,000, you know, and you add that up to 10 miles and you're looking like over $100,000 just to connect your home to an electrical line. So I think there have been innovative solutions using solar plus battery storage that, you know, companies and entities have been creating and making sure that they are providing power to the people in these rural remote places. And then, you know, once you have power, you're able to have that connectivity. You're able to, you know, look at maybe putting in a water system, you know, to do water pumping for your home to have running water. But it also increases the productivity of a home.
Yes.
Every household can range between 4 to 6 people. I mean, we're multi-generational kind of homesteads that we have throughout the country, in Indian country. And I think that, you know, COVID-19, we really saw like the inequalities in Indian country, where we have lack of water, lack of power and connectivity to be able to protect ourselves, right? And so I think this fueled a lot of interest locally and regionally and nationally to organize how we can structure, you know, working with the federal government and working with tribal governments and all of the entities, you know, the public, private sector, to really address energy access. And so that's part, yes, of my role. And I love our office. That's part of our statute, is to help with electrification of Native American homes. And then we also pushed for the Inflation Reduction Act there's 150 million that's allocated for electrifying Indian country that don't have access to power. So yeah, there's been a lot of movement here at our office and within the federal family about addressing this issue. And I'm just really honored to be a part of that.
We're honored to have you here. I've worked with Secretary Granholm in the past, and I'm really, really so impressed at the work your office is trying to do. I'm curious how you first came to be involved with energy work, Director. I've read about your life, and I know you come from a rural, remote community on the Navajo Reservation, and your family hauled water every day, little access to electricity. Broadband is kind of non-existent. I've heard you say that it was through water that you first became involved with this kind of work that has led you to the corridors of power in D.C.
Yes. Again, my homestead is about 2 miles from one of the largest coal strip mining areas in northeastern Arizona that powered Los Angeles, that powered Las Vegas, that powered Phoenix, pretty much the entire West. And then you go over the hill from the mining operations. To this day, there's so many families that don't have access to electricity like myself, don't have paved roads. And I think this really, you know, made me more curious about the history of coal mining in our communities and the policies that were put in place before I was born. They were decisions that were made before I was born. So, but, you know, I have a lot of family members that worked at the coal mines and made a living. And so, like, this balance of, you know, looking at the, the fact that we powered the entire West and we were like this battery, right? And and I think in this role is really trying to uplift these communities. I mean, it's not just in Navajo and Hopi, it's in the Powder River Basin. It's in Crow, the Crow tribe, Crow Nation also, you know, has been a power source for that region. Like that's Appalachia, right, as well. And you see a theme throughout these communities where many of them are, they don't have access to many resources and they are underfunded. And I think that, you know, I really wanted to work towards making sure that, you know, we understand the policies that are being passed or that are in front of us in our local community, that, that we are also empowering ourselves to make decisions for our future that will not hurt or harm our environment, that will not hurt and harm the way of life that we have as Indigenous people, as Native American people, to our cultural values. And that's something that I really heard from elders and learned from elders, is that we have a duty to protect water. You know, this mining operation used to use 3.3 million gallons of water every single day in this high desert region where we haul water to slurry coal as a transportation means, 300 miles away to a pipeline to Mojave Generating Station. And every day seeing this process take away our pristine water, and yet we have to haul water at very little cost, you know, that would I got to get really involved into the policy again and really advocate for the protection of our water, that wanted to advocate for something more sustainable and advocate for really our community to own and manage our power. I think that's the big piece here. And a theme within Indian country, you'll hear from every tribe that you talk to, is that, you know, every tribe wants to own and manage their power. And many times, you know, their ideas and values hasn't been included in any kind of policy decision making.
That's right.
Historically. So I think that we're seeing a beautiful trend happen right now where tribes are taking more leadership in the design of their energy, you know, future, in the design of their communities, and making sure that it reflects the values. And so that's been, you know, my journey, and it's been an honor to be in this role. I've been in this role for 3 years, and I've learned so much about government, and I've learned so much about the dedication that, you know, the team that I came in with the Biden-Harris administration has been really grounding for me, because there are many of many people just like me that are coming from communities that really want something good for the ones that have been left behind, for the communities that, you know, often struggle with energy burden and energy poverty. So that's, you know, one area that we've been trying to make sure that we make it equitable and just. So that's sort of, you know, my journey and how I came here.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back, Director. I find it so inspiring, and I so respect this administration for having people from the reservation actually working in your office and in your position after decades and decades of it just being white men with no stake in the well-being of people who live on the reservation. Now, let me quote you, Director. You have said, "For tribes, the values of sovereignty and self-determination are so important. If a project is designed right for the community, it can demonstrate that self-reliance and self-determination and sovereignty that tribes hold close. We want them to own their power. We want them to learn to manage their power." And I agree, but for so much of this country's history, as you well know, as you've discussed, native land and resources have been exploited for the energy needs, not of the people living on the reservations in a native land, but for non-native communities. So I'm curious, what are some of the more effective current strategies your office is proud of that are changing this dynamic? What should American voters know that's already been done and is in the process of changing?
Well, for Indian country, I feel like, you know, the one thing that it doesn't matter, you know, I think whatever state you're in, I mean, I grew up in Arizona and our connection to land, you know, goes way back before states formation. We have treaties that we sign with the federal government, and there is, you know, a trust responsibility we have to tribes. And every nation has their own how they came to be in as a federally recognized tribe. We have 574 federally recognized tribes that in this country and a commitment to. And I think that, you know, once you start to understand the history more and unpack, you know, like the 1923, you know, Electrification Act, you start to see, and I guess some of the barriers and want to advocate for the solutions and the, you know, things that will help benefit your people and your community. And, but the also, I think the biggest piece for our work is really the engagement. And how we do that engagement. We do it so well within the Office of Indian Energy. We have a great customer service team that offers grants. We offer financial assistance opportunities. We have the $50 million grant opportunity right now for clean energy technology. And within these 10 years, I always say tribes are leading the way to clean energy. They have been. For these 10 years, tribes have been planning. They have been designing clean energy projects to help weather climate impacts. And this is years ago. You know, some tribes are, you know, doing and designing these systems to weather flooding, to weather the forest fires, and in preparation for, you know, climate impacts. And so there's a lot we can learn from tribes. And there's a lot that we can also learn from tribes that, you know, carry that knowledge, that wisdom of the land, the water, the air, the seasons. I mean, gosh, tribes know a lot about this country and we can learn a lot from them. And I think this is the time, given that we are in this kind of climate crisis, where we should lean on, you know, Native American people, but also Indigenous people, because many of their lands, their waters, host, you know, the kind of more biodiverse regions in the world. And I think that and moving towards a way of, I mean, historically, they haven't, you know, we've went through boarding school. We went through different challenges of really trying to, you know, be assimilated into this American life way, I guess. And our people have really come through. And as far as, you know, understanding and not, you know, getting away from our own teachings. And I love that about tribes, is that they they still hold so much of their language and so much of their culture. And I don't see that going away anytime soon. So, and I think that's the value that we bring to states. That's a value we bring to communities, is that we just aren't, you know, people that don't know anything. We know a lot and we carry a
Indeed.
Lot.
Indeed. I mean, I was just reading about this $10 billion project, the SunZia transmission line. It's going to funnel renewable energy across the West. And it's hit a stall in Southwest Arizona because some tribes are saying that the government's ignored concerns about the effects this is going to have on various religious and cultural sites. So federal land managers have temporarily suspended work on the transmission product. It's about 50 miles long after they were asked for some intervention. And other tribes in the southwestern U.S. have also raised concerns, saying it holds cultural and historical significance for them as well. It seems like these are the kind of unforeseen considerations that will arise, which means so much more that people like you are working in the government who will appreciate and understand and respect these cultural and historical areas. But also, it reminds us, our national history is a lot older than 248 years, which most white people want to pretend is how old this land is.
Yeah, there are many beautiful areas that hold, you know, significant cultural values to our people, our perspective of our connection to everything, which is, you know, it's hard to sometimes for other people to believe, but we, you know, most of our ways are tied to nature. Yes. And again, it's if it weren't for that, like I wouldn't be in this role. You know, I have a great respect for nature, and everything we do is, you know, who we are. We give thanks to the elements and to all of that is living. It's not just, you know, us as humans. It's so many other amazing living things that we also have to be in harmony and balance with. And yes. I think, you know, that's just a little bit about like that Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous values that this administration has really prioritized of uplifting Indigenous knowledge in making decisions, federal agency decisions, and respecting sacred sites. We have a memorandum of understanding from agencies of, you know, how we are going to be working better with tribes so that we uphold our trust responsibility and uplift these values in the way that we are looking at these projects. And I think that, you know, there has to be a balance, right? I mean, right now, you have tribes and communities that have suffered, you know, over 50 years from energy development, that projects that probably didn't go well for the community. Mm-hmm. It might have damaged their water, their, you know, polluted their land and their health. And of course, there's a lot of tribes that are, you know, are hesitant to, you know, be open to other projects in their communities. And I think that's, you know, there's some distrust there. And I think for Indian country, my perspective is really, you know, there has to be a relationship that we need to, you know, work on with tribes.
Yes.
And an understanding that it's not just a transactional, you know, relationship, that it's really an understanding. And I think this is the part that takes work. It takes that dedicated engagement. It takes us kind of letting go of process and really, you know, moving towards a place of meeting tribes where they're at. And I think, you know, when you have what you mentioned, you know, we have to meet those tribes where they're at. Even though there's a timeline or whatever that the, you know, these projects have, when it comes to tribes and our lands and our waters, you know, there's also an obligation that tribes have to that. And so we have to respect that. And that's part of that learning process. So, yeah, I hope we can definitely improve the way that we have been engaging with tribes, the way that we are respecting their rights as well. And yeah, that's been an area that I've been really enjoying and learning more about.
Well, I thank you for your service and for your time with us today. And I'm so grateful that someone with your experience and your heritage is working in the halls of our government, especially in the Department of Energy. Wahala Johns is director of the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Indian Energy Policy and Programs. What is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your work, Ms. Johns?
We are at Indian Energy. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter.
Brilliant. It's an honor to have you with us. Please come back anytime. This platform is always open to you and people from your office doing your important work. Thank you so much.
Take care.